Live from Harmony, this is Derailed Trains of Thought. Welcome, Tim. We're in a desert.
Well, I got my cowboy outfit. Where's yours?
I don't know. I guess I'm...
It's a good thing you're usually wearing flannel anyway.
Yeah. At least I can blend in a little bit.
That helps you. Flannel jeans. You're just missing the hat and the... Let's see these six shooters here.
I know. I need to... I feel like this is a town we're going to need guns in.
Yeah. The crowd seems... the mob seems rather, well, mobbish.
Yeah. Like, there's this tree here. Maybe... Hopefully they don't do any hang-ins around here.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the town's called the Harmony. What could go wrong?
It should be great.
Yeah. Although, did you notice on the other side of that house, it looks like there's a different landscape? What's that all about?
I don't know. This is weird.
Yeah.
It's not normal. Hopefully we can find the sheriff or something.
Yeah. He'll make this place safe for sure. Anyway, welcome, folks.
Yes. Hello. Welcome to May. How's your health life, Tim?
I'm doing pretty good. Ready for another podcast on storytelling.
For the creator and the consumer?
Yes.
All right.
I tricked you into giving the catchphrase.
Yes. And I'm Nick Hayden.
And I'm Timothy Deal. Summer is just right around the corner. Feels like will be here any week now.
By the time this comes out, school should be over.
Ooh.
Which would be nice.
Congratulations.
Yeah, we're the principal at one of the elementary school program was like, people ask me, how's the school winding down? He's like, school does not wind down. It goes full blast till the end, which is true. Like, all the teachers are like, yep. It just fills in all the cracks with award ceremonies and track meets and everything else. So.
Well, the kids probably feel like it winds down because, like, they
have less work as they get close to the end. But for the teachers, it's like, until graduation, it's just like stuff to do.
Stuff to do.
Yep.
That makes sense. So,
all
cool.
Right. Let's go ahead to story school. All right, so this story school, I guess, was originally my idea. It's something I think we've touched on in various ways, but we're going to try to dig deeper or at a different angle than we have sometime.
Yeah, the reason why I was on the topic list for a while is I was a little like, is there enough here to cover? But we'll see.
We'll see. It was inspired quite a while ago. I was reading those little Penguin classic books that I got.
Like, those short ones.
Yeah, one called Traffic, written by John Ruskin, and it was kind of an essay or series of essays on art and things. And there was just a quote I found really interesting, and I guess wanted to discuss if it was true and what we could make of it. So it went like kind of like this. Well, it went exactly like this. I could show you that a nation cannot be affected by any vice or weakness without expressing it legibly and forever, either in bad art or by want of art. And that there is no natural virtue, small or great, which is not manifestly expressed in all the art which circumstances enable the people possessing that virtue to possess. Which I took to mean in normal language, non-Victorian language. Basically, if there's a weakness, a vice in a culture, it will obviously show up in the art. Mm-hmm. And if there's some sort of strength or virtue, it will show up in the art. And I just thought, it put into a nice, concise sentence that idea that I think we've talked obliquely about, but I don't know that we've ever said, hey, here's some examples and here's maybe analyzing our own culture or other. Ours is probably the most easy one to miss our weaknesses sometimes in our art and just say, okay, is this true?
Yeah.
Do we agree with it?
You know, it's interesting. When I had skimmed this quote of yours before, I think I had kind of summed it up as like, okay, yes, art is kind of a mirror to what's going on in a culture. It seems in some ways kind of obvious, particularly since we talk about that all the time.
Yeah.
But it's interesting listening to you read it this time. I was really struck about the talking about the vices and virtues kind of dichotomy, that reflecting the good and the bad.
And I think it's worth just taking a moment, because we can always look back at old art and be like, oh yeah, that's how they were back in that time, the Victorians or whatever.
Mm.
But I think when you're in the moment, you kind of sometimes unconsciously later like, oh yeah, that's what I was, that was something good. Or that was something we were processing or whatever.
Yeah. I think it is easy for a lot of conservative commentators, especially, to look at examples of art that is showing the decadence of our society, our vices, our failures, because it's very easy to point out certain types of content, like, you know, that's blasphemous, or that's explicit, or that's gratuitous.
But I guess my question is, going a little deeper, is it just that, oh, these things are bad and we're showing, is that showing versus... Is that, okay, these are weaknesses, these are vices, and showing up in art? Or is it more like, I guess by deeper thing, it's like, say there's lots of swearing. Okay, so does it just say our culture is full of swearing, or does it tell deeper about our inability to use language well, to express things, or that, or the fact that we are uncouth, that we don't have gentility or something? I mean, I guess I would like to try to say, can we dig, okay, say we have lots of, you know, skin on TV. What does that say?
Yeah.
Besides just, hey, we're sinners. I mean, that's baked in the cake of every culture.
I mean, I hope that one of the things we do with our discussions, I don't think that we tend to get very like black and white about like, I mean, there's certain things we'd rather not see nudity in our movies or,
Gangs of New York.
We don't have an overabundance. We don't tend to go for movies that have an overabundance of F-bombs or like. But on this podcast, what we talk a lot about is, Why is this part of storytelling? Why do these elements, good or bad elements, show up in storytelling a lot? Like, why are we interested in what role does food have in stories?
Yeah, exactly.
We like to look at the width and breadth of these things. So I think it is interesting to think about, okay, what are our, going the other way, what are the our current cultural trends that we see in modern storytelling?
And I guess to add one more sort of element to this, I don't have a link to it. I read it quite a while ago, but I read this article about how during the Cold War, the CIA funded abstract art in America. And the purpose was that in Russia, basically, to make art, you had to be approved by the state. And the CIA wanted to show Russian artists that here we had freedom of expression, that you could do whatever you wanted with art, that it didn't have to apply to just what the state wanted, I guess. And it's just an interesting commentary that in some ways the CIA at that point thought that helping encourage modern art, abstract art, create this sense that, look, no, we value freedom.
Yeah.
And so it was like almost a reverse engineering of Ruskin's quote that like our art is showing where our virtues are.
Yeah.
And so I think I find that element, that idea that like those big ideas, those big, what do we value on the big and not just the individual sins or virtue, but like big picture stuff. You know, if you look again, any piece of art, you could say the creator values this, doesn't value that. And we do that a lot on here.
Well, I mean, that feels almost like a whole discussion of in and of itself, the patrons and the arts, you know, this, what kinds of arts are being funded by the people who have the money.
Yeah.
You know, back in the Renaissance period, a lot of that was by the church actually. Mm-hmm. Even during the Renaissance, like even though you had the Enlightenment thing going on, there was still, we were reading not too long ago about in a book of ours for small group.
Caravaggio?
Yes, Caravaggio. Thank you. How a lot of his stuff was commissioned by people in the church. And so he painted a lot of religious paintings. And then the CIA example. Yep. But the weird flip side of that is that, you know, then you have governments basically funding propaganda.
Yeah.
You know, it can go into that territory too. But that may be a whole other thing.
Well, let's go back to Caravaggio and then Michelangelo and that whole Renaissance thing is that there was a move to basically, and I'm not great in my art history, but to basically elevate the human body. They're saying the human body was this art form that in Middle Ages, everything was stylized in Middle Ages, and suddenly there's this realism to the human body.
Okay.
This sort of, and that was built on the kind of the Enlightenment idea of, well, not Enlightenment, but I guess starting the Renaissance, that, you know, that human reason, that humanity is this great thing, and that it's important. You know, we're still doing religious art, but then there's this movement towards, you know, Sistine Chapel. You got God and Adam. You know, Adam's like, okay, God, I'll touch your finger.
Whatever.
You know, this idea that the human form, that the human being is almost divine in itself.
Yeah.
And so that's coming through the art in certain ways. So I think...
I mean, and Caravaggio's approach was a little different We've been reading this book. We're not experts on art, but we've been reading this book called Rembrandt.
It's fascinating.
Called Rembrandt is in the Wind. And Caravaggio has been noted for drawing humans in very earthly sort of situations, like the downtrodden and all this kind of stuff, in a more approachable way than maybe some of the iconography of the church had been doing.
Yeah, it broke down a lot of the symbols into, I guess, everyday life, popularism in some ways.
Which we still do that with Bible stories today. I mean, that's kind of what The Chosen, the TV series, is all about.
Yeah.
Like kind of breathing human life into these stories that we've known for so long. I guess we're getting a little bit off to our main topic.
Yeah, but I think those are just historical examples of art showing some of the big philosophical thrusts of, and people do this study all the time, of the Romantic era. We loved our emotion and our, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But then I think Ruskin just saying, that's true all the time. And I think it's just interesting to say, okay, what does that mean? I mean, what do our movies say about us? And which I've asked that question before, but I think I always find it fascinating.
You know, it's interesting, too, to think about how this may be another slight tangent, but yeah. We won't dwell on it long. But sometimes art is informed by culture, but then sometimes culture is informed by art.
Yeah, it's a circle.
Like Uncle Tom's Cabin is a prime example of a novel that had a big influence mm-hmm. on the culture that it came out in.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I think it probably captured in some ways what part of the culture that couldn't get a voice was saying.
Yeah.
It's not like it created out of nowhere this anti-slavery movement.
True, true.
So, I mean, you're right. It created culture and it sparked changes. But, mm-hmm. and I think, like we talked before we started recording here, that in some ways the problem with doing this to our modern culture is that it's so, the art forms are so splint, they're all over the place. There's not a monolithic.
We're fragmented thing. All over the place. It's not like it was during the 50s or even before that, the 30s and 40s. Was a time when the nation, this wide nation, was united by radio. Mm-hmm. Everyone could, it was the first time with old time radio, that was the first time people on the West and East Coast were sharing the same experiences live, mm-hmm. even though they were separated by like 3 hours of time. But we don't have that now. We don't even have it when it was a TV thing. And like the season or the series finale of MASH, which yep. is like, I don't remember now, 20 million people watching or something. Yeah. You can't even get numbers like that for the Super Bowl anymore.
Well, I guess even that difference or dilemma also is art reflecting culture. I mean, the fact that our art is not monolithic anymore. I mean, not that it was always completely, but nowadays that says something about us. That we are probably far more individualistic now, I would guess, than when MASH was out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, it's ironic because it's more individualistic, but it's all these like little sub communities that have found each other. I mean, sure, there are some very cult small followings, but it seems like people are constantly being surprised by how many people are into something else that they're not into.
Yeah.
Like, for example, all the movie critics hated they were just lambasting the Mario movie before it came out. And yet it became way bigger than any of them realized, because people who are movie people don't realize just how big the gaming community has become now.
I mean, in some ways, it's bigger than the movie community.
It is. I think finances are bigger. Like, it makes more money per year than the movie industry does, which is bizarre.
Which is interesting. Well, that's a whole different discussion.
Yeah.
We could tackle sometime. But so what do you think, Tim, if you had to prognosticate, I don't know if that's proper use of that word, or just use a crystal ball, look in the kind of the last, say, 5-10 years of, or even 20 years of, let's just take visual arts. Maybe that's easier in some ways than books. I don't keep up with modern books.
There are a lot.
What do you think are the trends, both virtue or vices?
Well, you had sent me an article by, I think it was Carl Truman?
Yes, who wrote The Rise and Triumph of the Modern Self.
Oh, yeah, okay. His article, it kind of struck me as kind of one-sided version of like view of the decadence of art and the decadence of our current society. And I can agree with that. You can certainly see a lot in our current art that is all about breaking traditional morals, morality. Yeah.
Or what's left of
transgressions, all that kind of stuff. The weird flip side of all this is that I see, at least like, this is coming from a looking at audience of gamers and mm-hmm. kind of geek culture, which unfortunately I wish we had a more broad spectrum sometimes. I mean, I love that we have this common ground that we can talk on, but I do realize that we are coming from a very specific perspective on American culture. But in those community, I see a lot more interest, while not denying it, that there's interest in the purists, but also there's an interest in the pure and the coming together in wholesomeness. I've seen gamers say the word wholesome way more often than I would have probably 10 years ago. Usually it tends to refer to like some relationship aspect of the story.
Okay.
For example, I'm going to go back to Mario movie.
Yeah.
So for years, you know, gamers have made jokes about Mario kind of overshadowing his brother Luigi, about Mario getting all the attention. Sometimes the joke is like he's doing that on purpose. But in this movie, you saw Mario really team up with Luigi and they saw the importance of their relationship as brothers. And that excited a lot of people that were like, yeah, they're bros. You know, Mario could have had the last fight to himself, but no, he shared it with his brother Luigi and it was awesome. That kind of stuff, I think, and people talk about that in other video games, and whether it's a sibling relationship, whether it's found families. We've talked about how
family's a giant thing.
Family's a giant thing. And I feel like it's people talk about that as a harking to something that they're longing for.
Well, I was going to ask that because at least Ruskin in his quote indicates that art reflects virtue or vice. But in this case, it seems like it more reflects an aspiration. I don't think the wholesome or like the theme of family shows so much stuff. Culture, I'm not sure it's so much so like, hey, we're really good at families.
Yeah.
Or we're really good at being wholesome. It's more like we wish we were.
Yeah, I think that's true.
And I think that I guess that's both a virtue and a vice in the sense that like it's virtue like that we want it.
Mm-hmm.
But it's vice of the fact that we don't.
Yeah.
I don't know. Because this quote doesn't have anything to do with aspirations.
True. No, I think it is an example of our kind of bipolar nature of our culture. To use what I see as a negative example from that same movie.
Yeah.
So you had this cliche that they use with the Luma, the little star creature,
yeah.
Who's cute and cuddly looking, should be, except that this one is like
nihilistic,
like it's super depressed, it just wants to die, and it keeps making all the jokes is like this cute little innocent thing is making all these depressing comments about death. And that's been a joke for a while. Like even way back when I was in college, there was the Flash cartoon Happy Tree Friends, which was all these little cute, cuddly creatures that would get like slaughtered in gory ways. And you had the web comic, The Bunny Suicides.
You know,
this idea of an innocent thing being secretly something dark has been around for a while. And yet there are a lot of cute toads that are still just cute in the Mario movie. So
I think you're right, and it's maybe there's in all cultures, but it does seem like our art is particularly bipolar.
Mm.
It's like it both wants the family and the wholesomeness, but also a lot of it is also tinged at least with some level of nihilism.
Yeah,
not like selling it, but it's just it exists. Like, of course, this is just part of life. This sense that we don't know what meaning is.
Yeah,
because like I know you haven't seen it yet, so I won't say much. But I watched Guardians of the Galaxy 3. And obviously they have a big thing about coming together and family and friends sticking out for, you know, which is great and works really well in the movie. But there is also just scenes where like just massive people die, you know, you just kill things because it's cool, you know, they look cool.
Yeah.
And so we have this weird dichotomy between wanting things to look cool and then also this, but we want this deep meaning that comes from deep connection with other people.
Mm-hmm. So another example is, I just had to mention it because we had way back in the day, you may recall our, I think it was in What If, we did Michael Bay redirecting The Wizard of Oz.
Oh, yes.
Well, the other day, I happened to come across this on some movie website, this upcoming thing called Mad Heidi.
Okay.
Which is, I'm just going to read you this very brief description of what this movie is about. In a dystopian Switzerland that has fallen under the fascist rule of an evil cheese tyrant, Heidi lives the pure and simple life in the Swiss Alps. Grandfather Alfoy, however you say that, does his best to protect Heidi, but her yearning for freedom soon gets her in trouble with a dictator's henchman. The innocent girl transforms herself into a kick, but female fighting force who sets out to liberate the country from the insane cheese fascists.
Okay.
So, yeah. And I think at some point it calls itself, the very first Swissploitation film. It's like an exploitation film, but
of Swiss.
Of Swiss, yes.
I think we have a lot of that because, I mean, not of Swissploitation, but but of this idea of taking something that's, I guess, innocent or normal or wholesome, or maybe just cliche, depending on your point of view, and changing into, but it's strong and will beat everyone up and it's carries a gun.
Yeah, it's a weird position that we find ourselves in with that kind of stuff because, I mean, it's a whole feminist argument. Like, on the one hand, it's like, yes, women can do whatever they want. But on the other hand, does that just mean you want to turn them all into action heroines?
Yeah, because that's a whole other discussion. But I think we do have a certain confusion about what is a good thing for a man or woman to do in a movie, even. Mm-hmm. Like, well, we just got to keep changing up because, I mean, there's flaws on the other side. We have all the damsels in distress.
Yeah.
That's saying something else about your culture.
Right.
But.
And this sort of description, I mean, obviously they're going very tongue in cheek with this business with like cheese fascists or whatever. Yeah. It's like, okay, haha. But it's one of those things like how much of this sort of tongue in cheek ridiculousness, at what point does it stop being clever and just becomes cliche?
Oh, and I think that's the other thing is that we often complain. We've mentioned on the show before the constant recycling.
Yeah.
Of art. What does that say about our culture? Where, now, again, you could look far enough. There's a lot of unique, clever stuff happening.
For sure.
But the big power movers are not always very creative anymore. And what does that say about, at least what they think is valued?
Yeah. And like I said, it's easy for us to get focused on the bad of what's currently going on in society. But I do want to like note that, again, this longing for something good, even if we're doing it in a bipolar way, I think is a sign of what people are looking for, but just not understanding how to do it. I mean,
because we all want deep connection, but I think we're also, it's harder to do because it takes a lot of effort to be deeply connected with another person.
Mm.
And we've had COVID, you know, things that have isolated people even more than just modern life does naturally.
I mean, I think it takes a lot of intentionality. So for an example that I'll probably talk a little bit more in the second half, the Muppets just recently had a new show, Muppets Mayhem. Yay! You should go check it out. It's a lot of fun. But one thing that this one gets right that the last Muppet series got wrong, the Muppets 2015 sitcom, is that one, it tried to make the Muppets too realistic, too quote-unquote adult.
Yeah.
Which kind of translated to them kind of not liking their job. And
that seems like, very anti-Muppet, generally.
It does. They were trying to put them into like a sitcom akin to The Office, essentially, and it just didn't work.
These Muppets are, at the base, they're joyful.
Right. What Muppets Mayhem does better in that regard is that it's all about the Electric Mayhem, and they love what they do. The Electric Mayhem is very, they're the wholesome people, and then the humans that are kind of the new characters, they're the ones that usually, in most episodes, where the conflict comes from.
Yeah, which makes sense.
It makes sense. There's a wannabe producer who's trying to make a name for herself in the business, and you've got this little romantic, it's a romantic triangle going on with some of the side characters.
Okay. Triangle, quadrangle.
I don't think it's quite that complicated this time. But anyway, I'm sure it took a lot of intentionality to, because keeping the Muppets consistent with who they should be and coming up with new stuff for them to do in a fresh, modern way is a challenge. And I'm sure they, you know, they thought long and hard about these things.
Well, because they're interesting too, because in some ways they are anachronistic.
Yeah.
I mean, because they existed in their the Jim Henson, original. Well, how long ago is that now?
Well, are you talking about the Muppet Show?
Muppet Show, or even some of the movies. We're talking at least 30 years, though, aren't we?
Like 40, 45 at this point.
And so, I mean, in some ways, the culture has changed substantially, but you don't want the Muppets to.
Yeah. They're funny characters in that way. Like, they actually mention at some point that they've been around for, like, somewhere like 40 to 50 years, and yet they're obviously not 40 obviously not that old.
Yeah.
So they are in a strange amalgamation that way.
Well, what other what do you think other maybe virtues? Because you know, it is easy to just be like grumpy old man. But do you think that maybe our art reflects on us? I think the family and the wanting for wholesome relationships is certainly a big one.
Mm-hmm. Again, just looking at nerd culture, like the search for wonder, I think is still a recurring thing.
I can see. Okay.
Like whether you're talking about a Marvel movie where you're going into the quantum realm, or you're talking about a Star Wars thing, Star Wars Visions, the animated shorts that they do a really good job, I think, of capturing a sense of wonder.
Mm-hmm.
Again, partly because the Visions things are like non-canon.
They go out of the box.
They can do all kinds of stuff. And some of it is really beautiful.
You know what? I just occurred to me, it doesn't always come out well, but I think there's still a strong sense of justice. It comes through a lot of art. Sometimes it's taken into your own hands sort of stuff, but most people still don't want the bad guy to get away.
Yeah, that's
you know,
true.
Like how it happens might be, we might not agree with in certain films.
Yeah.
But it does seem like that there's still that like, no, look, some people have it coming.
Yeah, yeah. Also the sense of togetherness, I guess that kind of goes along with the relationship stuff we've been mentioning, but the sense of like, we love seeing all the Avengers come together on a big massive thing, or anything where he's like, oh, I love those people. I love these people. Let's see them come together and fight against a common cause, or fight against a common enemy.
Connections, just of any sort. Like, let's connect universes, connect genres, connect. I think there is a bigger love of, I mean this in the broadest sense as well, just of diversity, that we like, not everything needs to be the same. Like, we like this superhero and this superhero completely different. We want to throw together these genres. We love mixing them together in new ways. Like, there is a certain amount of, like, openness to different things, which I think is not a bad thing either.
Yeah. I do think sometimes conservatives are ready to throw the bath out with the bathwater in some of these things. Like, oh, diversity, you know, you're just being politically correct. There's good value in this. It just, yes, a certain side of the aisle will tend to elevate some of these morals higher than they really need to be, as people do with any heresy.
Yeah.
But we have to recognize where the good is and find the right balance.
Yeah, because I think it's very Christian to have, like, lots of different parts of the body. I mean, that's a good the metaphor.
Exactly. So how about you? You've been asking me what are some virtues, and I guess you just named
a couple of virtues. Okay, I'll throw one more vice in, just because one that I tend to notice, I was just thinking about it. In some aspects of video game culture, and I think it kind of started around like the movie 300, that sort of era, just this hyper, I don't want to say glorification of violence, but just this like obsession with the hero being so awesome and just decimating the other side. And sometimes a lot of times it can be a lot of fun, but like when this happens all the time, it's just sort of this like devaluation of, I don't know if life, I don't know if I want to go that far, but just this flippancy, I guess. A flippancy of mean, like movies or TV shows sometimes want to both take seriously this, we care about my friend, I'll do anything for it, but also then like I can wipe out 100 people just for a cool action scene.
I guess
again, some of that bipolar.
Yeah.
Like we care deeply about the people we care about.
Yeah.
And the throwaways we'll spend 10 minutes doing a cool fight scene on. Which again, not that it didn't happen previously, no, 80s action movies, like that just what happens. But it seemed like we stylize it more. I don't know what exactly that means.
I kind of want to say this is the Matrix effect.
Matrix effect, yeah, Matrix 2. Yeah, it's been going on for a while now.
Yeah, yeah. It feels like something that started with like that.
Yeah, Matrix era, probably a better beginning.
That and like the, and even the proliferation of anime in some ways. You've got
has a lot of that going on.
A lot
on.
Of characters who are like super powerful and can just wipe the floor with scores of bad guys. I mean, I guess it was also a thing in Kung Fu before then. So, yeah.
It just seems heightened. And, you know, just because I teach middle schoolers, they're, you know, there's all kinds of, you know, shooting games, which, again, I'm not necessarily against, but, like, middle schoolers are flipping anyways, but, or can be. Yeah. I don't know. It's just an interesting trend that way. And I don't know what that, if it says anything, just lack of, I don't know if seriousness is the right word. In some things. Again, not that you want it into everything, because, you know, blow up a Death Star, I don't really want to know that there are so many people on it. But then again, it's not stylized or glorified either.
Yeah.
It just
happened.
It just happened, just like Alderaan happened. You know, it's just like, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a tricky one.
So I don't know. That's just...
It feels like more of an observation in some way. Well, I mean, it is in a...
I don't know how much it should read into it at this point. I'm not sure I can make a definitive statement.
Yeah.
But other virtues, I mean, got the justice, I agree with the family. There is still a subculture of the clever kids, which I always kind of love. Like the, you know, you got Lemony Snicket, you have the Benedict Society. We watch that stuff because I think it's good to have like this, you don't see a ton, but like, hey, they're smart and they like books and they do stuff. And there's still that hanging around, you know, Bluey. There's this, at least this subsection of kid stuff that's very, very wholesome, you know, and in a good way.
Yeah.
I mean, I think there's a lot of push towards that. I think that's good.
Just making an observation of, we were talking beforehand about our fractured culture and all these different things. And you mentioned, I think before we started recording, Blue Bloods.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah.
Which has a massive audience, but is not talked about by the cool cultural TV commentators, really. But I feel like, well, if you're to pull a value out of a lot of the TV police procedurals, a lot of that sort of stuff is that law enforcement is competent and able to help us, and it's a comforting thing to be able to see the detectives take out the terrorists and stuff like that.
And either it's a virtue / aspiration that you want the people in charge to be good people.
Yeah.
That you want them to be...
To be good people. Yeah,
and do their job and bring justice, and I would agree with that. And it's interesting because I'm watching with my son Battle in 5 again. You have this
girl, is what, your third, fourth watch through?
Something like that, yeah. Probably fourth. All together. But you have the interesting thing that the leadership battle in 5 has this justice and this goodness, but then there you have the corrupt too, and so you have this, you know, both
back on Earth
it's very satisfying to be like, we're standing for right, and we're not going to cut corners or anything to do it.
Yeah, yeah, no, heroes is still a very important part, I think, of our.
They're sometimes
American
messier
culture
nowadays, but we still want heroes.
We still want heroes. I mean, there's a reason why people cared a lot about Captain America and Thor and Iron Man and all these guys.
Because they're still, I think everyone still wants someone who deeply believes something and won't budge on it.
Yeah.
And again, I'm not sure that shows virtue as much as the aspiration, but I think that's good.
And ideals are useful.
And ideals are necessary.
Yeah.
I mean, the more we have art like that, the more we are likely to become like that.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's why you know, bring around is that it just comes back to what we talked about all the time, is that one of the purposes of art is to make us into the people we want to be.
Right. Yeah. I'll just throw in as kind of a coda here. It occurs to me there's a villain in Star Wars lore that loves studying the artworks of cultures in order to understand his enemies.
Yes, exactly.
Mr. Grand Admiral Thrawn from the novels, and then later brought back into canon through other novels and on the TV show. And they touched on that because that was such an important part of his character in Rebels, that they did mention the his, I mean...
And in Thrawn the book is, I read, he does it too.
In what?
In the book I read, the okay. Thrawn, yeah.
He still does it. I mean, because it's such an important part of his character. He's such a anti-imperialist imperial in some ways, that in order to understand someone, you really must study the artworks of his culture.
And that's what, you know, just to throw a plug in here, that's at least one thing that happens in Let's Finally Watch This, in our other podcast, is that as we're going through centuries, not that much.
Film's not quite that old.
When we go through the decades, we're also saying, okay, what does this kind of say about the moment that we're watching, 1942 or 1962? Mm-hmm. In our other podcast, The Weekly Hijack, we're going through Prisoner, which is a very 60s and capturing somewhat of that zeitgeist of cultural change.
During the Cold War.
During Cold War and just, you know, culture change. And it's... Not just about that, but you can tell it's deeply influenced by that, both what they would want people to be, number six, and also just all the things they're afraid of in the village.
And it's also kind of a commentary of this clash between modernism and postmodernism.
Yep.
I'm not sure if they would say that, but we can see
that. We can see that easily,
from our vantage point. Yeah, and we've been focusing on American Western culture.
We know it
primarily.
Best.
We know it best.
I don't want to. I don't want to badly judge another culture when I don't know their art very well.
It's true. I mean, the other culture we probably know the best is probably Japanese. Mm-hmm. You could say some things about, like, man, I'm a little tired of a cliche in anime and video games I play of organized religion always being the bad guys.
Yeah, that's a very Japanese thing. In the ones I've seen it a number of times.
Yeah. It's come up several times. Well, I'm like, really? Again?
Like, joke. And again, it's an exaggeration, but it does seem like Japanese art is very, very creative, but doesn't like to come down on any fact, you know?
Yeah.
Like, you can't hold anything too sure. Now, again, that's an exaggeration. But, like, even if you compare, like, JRPGs and American RPGs, you see vast differences in what we value.
Yeah. That's true. I mean, I guess in some ways, the American RPGs tend to be a little bit more individualistic. Like, it's all about you're building up your character and all your stuff and customizing.
You know, Skyrim, you're running around, you're doing missions that you feel like doing, you become the sort of person you want to be. There's a story, but that's not really what it's about.
And you don't have, like, a party, necessarily, that you're hanging out with.
JRPGs, like Sudoken, like, hey, collect all 100 side characters and start a tower. Or, like, Dragon Quest 7, like, hey, one of your major side quests is to build the city. Actually, Xenoblade. Hey, you're going to restart the city. You're always building cities in these RPGs and, like, massive amounts of characters. Final Fantasy VI. Hey, yeah, you only have 13 characters you can choose from or something like that. And again, when was the last time you saw an American RPG that had, like, more than, like, I don't know, a lot of them, two or three?
Yeah.
I mean, Zelda, just some guy running around by himself, sometimes just visit a village.
Okay, that's not a good example because that's still developed by Japanese developers.
Oh, that's true. That's true. But, okay, take that back.
But I'm sure, I don't know Western RPGs as much, but from every time I see them, yeah, it seems they're usually just one guy off on his own.
Yeah.
Is what it feels like.
Very, very Western.
Yeah, that's true.
All right, so I guess that's probably it.
I think we've covered a broad range here.
Yes, okay. Well, then we'll end with that and we'll go to... soundtrack. So my soundtrack today, I just thought, hey, we're talking different cultures. I'm like, I would just pick one of these games where they kind of use that as a way of separating people. I'm like, oh, Street Fighter. I used to play in the arcade quite a bit, and I realized that outside of one episode many, many moons ago, where our guest Nathan Marchand was here, we have never done Street Fighter music, which is a shame because there's a lot of good music.
It is a very popular genre.
What's your name?
Franchise.
Write the music for it. Final Fantasy XV composer.
Oh, Yoko Shimomura.
Yeah, she worked on it.
Oh, that's right. I forgot about that.
So I just picked one of them that I thought was fun by DJ Pretzel because he's great. This is kind of old school. It's called High 500. It's the E Honda Japan setting. Enjoy. It's fun. And we're back.
Well, that was fun.
Yeah, it was good stuff.
I mean, DJ Pretzel, he created OC Remix, so he better have some good music.
Yes. He's on the newest album, actually.
Ah.
The Final Fantasy VIII album.
I have not checked that out yet.
Actually, song number one.
Yeah.
Anyways, let's go ahead to Once Upon a Scene. So last month, Tim, we had a quote. Would you replay that for us?
Here we go.
Hey.
Hey. I was just trying on my Halloween costume.
What exactly are you supposed to be?
Space cowboy.
Okay, A, there are no cows in space. B, didn't you wear that like 5 years ago?
So?
So don't you think you should move on?
I like it.
And we had one of our listeners email us.
An old friend, a guest of the podcast, Nathan Marchand, correctly identified that this is from the TV show Castle.
Where apparently, I've not seen this, but Nathan Fillion was wearing his Firefly outfit.
Yes, something for the fans who were still longing for Firefly back in those days. I mean, honestly, some of them still are, but...
It's over, guys.
It's over. You get over it. You should really just move on.
All right. Anyway, that was good. I did not know that one. I'm like, that voice sounds familiar, but I never watched Castle.
Yeah.
And now we have a new scene.
For you to listen to and guess.
So go ahead and play it, Tim.
All right.
There's no more truth out there than there is in the world I created for you. Same lies. The same deceit. But in my world, you have nothing to fear.
So if you know that line, where it's from, whether it's some video game or movie or TV show or audio drama or fill in the blank, get a hold of us at derailedtrains@gmail.com.
I'm trying to think right now if there is any other audio story. I guess it could be like maybe a live theater production.
That
or something.
Could, yeah, it could be a live theater production.
Yeah.
One of those. YouTube video.
A YouTube video, yes, yeah. You never know.
A gramophone.
I don't know that they did a story. Well, now I'm curious. I have to look into that.
It's from one of the things we sent down Voyager on the Golden Record.
But yes, send us an email at derailedtrains@gmail.com.
You can also just message us on Facebook or
yes.
I guess occasionally we'll check Twitter.
Check what was that?
Twitter. Twitter.
If we remember what the website is called.
Yes. I haven't been on it forever. I don't think I know. I don't know if I know my password right now, and that's why I haven't checked it. But I don't actually care that much either. Anyways, we'll go into our take
on Tales.
So in January, we always do our
book club review.
Book club. But then, you know, it's been a while. It's been most of half a year. And we're like, things happen.
Most of half a year. Well, yeah, January, May. Yeah, okay. But yes, we've watched all.
Don't you know 5/6 is known as most of half a year in math?
What are you teaching your students in your math class?
Most of half of something.
Oh, man. Okay. So, yes, there's been stories we've been reading or watching and playing. And
some we can't talk about, but we'll save it for next January.
That's true.
But there's some other things as well. So do you want to start off, Tim?
Well, I feel like let's start off with one that we've both seen.
Okay.
One that I think it behooves us to talk about. We've talked about Star Wars many a time.
It's basically... I was going to say mandatory, the Mandalorian together, but I couldn't manage it.
Mandatorian?
Yeah, Mandatorian.
But yes, the Mandalorian season 3. Interesting contrast here. I feel like this season has gotten way less attention than back in season 1 did.
Yes.
Which is kind of a shame because it was a fun season.
I thought it was. I really enjoyed it. I thought it was a pretty strong season. It started off sort of like, where is this going? But it pulled together really well, and it was like a pretty epic finale.
Yeah, for sure. No, I really enjoyed the exploration of Mandalorian culture, and granted, Din Djarin is not the main focus of a lot of the big story arcs, but I don't feel like he has to be.
No, he's kind of the anchor. He's just sort of like who we're following around as we do stuff, and he's the everyman in some ways. And him and Grogu, while there's none of that tension of him trying to protect him because that's over.
Yeah, you know, they're together now.
But there's still growth for both of them in many ways, and growth in their relationship together. And yeah, just the whole Mandalorian mythos is just really fun and a nice... Now, I haven't watched Clone Wars or Rebels, but...
The animated series.
Yeah, even without that, I think it just... it opens this whole area of Star Wars that it's just really fascinating. And it's, I always think the Mandalorians are basically kind of like a Jedi cult without the Force power.
Yeah,
I have the weird quasi-religious thing going on. It's just kind of neat.
Yeah, in my opinion, Mandalorians have never been cooler.
Yeah.
Like, in Clone Wars, they're in the midst of, they touch on it a lot in this, how Mandalorians have often been in conflict with each other, and it's really torn them apart. And in Clone Wars, you've got, like, the government's on this very pacifistic streak, and you've got this faction called Death Watch that it wants to be more aggressive. And they talk about how Mandalorians have fought with the Jedi in the past. But the interesting thing about where they're at in this series is the idea of them rebuilding their culture, mm-hmm. essentially, that they've been humbled. And I don't know, I really enjoy seeing a society redemption story.
Yeah, and I guess it's also just, I've said on here before, I like consequence stories.
Mm.
You know, this is the rebuilding after something, in the same way that sort of weird side episode where we're on Coruscant with the basically reformed Imperials, which is also at least... story-wise, very fascinating to me. Like, you have to deal with all this baggage of this giant galactic war.
Yeah.
And I find that stuff interesting.
It was an interesting concept that I saw some people refer to as, like, well, how the Mandalorian took over a couple episodes of the Book of Boba Fett for some reason. It kind of felt like Andor took over one episode of this. Not that it had any characters from Andor, but the feeling was similar in some ways. And it did kind of come out of nowhere, and it's in a strange place right now. I mean, Clone Wars was more of an anthology show in some ways. You could do stories all around the galaxy about everything. The Mandalorian has this expectation that it's about, well, then the Djarin and Grogu and those that they are working with. So to have this side thing somewhere else felt really out of left field.
Yeah, it did. They made it work, and it is kind of a, I guess, cultural redemption story as well in some ways.
In some ways.
At least on a micro level.
Mm-hmm. It does kind of make me feel that they... I don't know. I'll be curious to see what they do with the Ahsoka show, if it'll be kind of similar, her just kind of venturing around the galaxy, or if they'll find some way in one of these live-action Star Wars shows to do more of a anthology, where they, because there's certainly a lot of fertile ground to be explored in this era of the Star Wars universe.
And I have to just say, I mean, as always, the look for a TV show is just...
It's astonishing.
It's astonishing. And
some of the things that they can do is, like, the budget that they put into this thing is just amazing. Like, it's almost a shame in some ways that we don't get to see this on the big screen.
Yeah. And I think, like the other seasons, it does capture a pretty good sense of the adventure of Star Wars.
Yeah.
And the exploration. And it gives its own flavor. We have a detective story. It was really enjoyable. Thumbs up.
Yeah. No, I mean, what's always fun with this show and The Bad Batch feel very much like I'm stepping into a world that I know pretty well.
Yeah.
They feel like good classic Star Wars. Now, interestingly enough, I was very slow to the boat in starting Andor.
Which I've seen all of, you've seen two-thirds of, basically.
Yeah, a little over half. I'm not somewhere between one half and two-thirds, I'd say. I just finished episode 7. And the reason I was dragging my feet on this so much was I knew it was a much grittier show. And I'm always hesitant. Like, if Clone Wars taught me anything, is that there is room for a lot of different types of Star Wars stories.
Mm-hmm.
Because that series had all kinds of stuff. It had war stuff. It had some mythological kind of focused episodes. It had some, again, the detective kind of thing. Again, some of the war stuff was very much down in the trenches kind of gritty war stuff, except still accessible for kids. Andor feels a lot more like the sort of story that some people who really love the expanded universe novels would get into. It feels much more ground level kind of stuff, more realistic, which I've always felt is a weird place for Star Wars. I'd like Star Wars as escapist fantasy.
Yeah.
Granted, Andor is essentially Star Wars as a dystopian.
Yes.
And to be fair, during the Empire,
it kind of works.
It makes sense. Yeah, there's a reason why that works. But it's not going to be everyone's cup of tea, I think.
No, I mean, I'll say I very much enjoyed it. But again, you know, I grew up on reading a lot of just hard science fiction, too.
Sure.
Like, to me, it's like, in many ways, it's hard, it's science fiction Star Wars versus fantasy Star Wars. And both of them, like, Mandalorian's fantasy Star Wars.
Right.
And most of the movies are fantasy Star Wars.
Right.
But I did feel like it did capture a sense of, I felt like it was a Star Wars world, just
a different side of it.
Tilted different, which,
yeah.
Again, you and I are built a little different like that, because, like, I read some of the the books I always talk about, the one war book with the Dawn in the Trenches, I thought was really cool. So, like,
yeah,
Andor I found fascinating, and I'm pretty excited about season two whenever they run it out, because I think it just is really good storytelling. I wouldn't want all Star Wars to be, I don't think, I'm not even sure the majority of Star Wars should be like this, but I think there is place, at least for me, for this sort of, especially in this time period,
yeah,
of the Empire growing and stuff.
Yeah, it definitely reminded me of, I mean, I haven't read nearly as many Star Wars novels as you have, but it reminded me of some of the more focus on intrigue and subtlety.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
particularly, I just watched an episode where Mon Mothma was talking with another person, basically subtly getting him on the side, but not actually talking about, she never used the word rebellion.
Oh, man, some of those scenes are very coded.
Yes, all the things that she's saying without actually saying them, and yeah, the amount of subterfuge that they have to go through, it feels very different from the rebellion that's full of, it has none of the swagger of a Han Solo.
No.
Or in the smugglers. It has none of that. It's all extremely held tight secrets kind of stuff.
Yeah. And I guess also, I mean, just visually, it's also pretty, I mean, it's a completely different visual thing, but it was very enjoyable. Like when they escaped the, it made bank heist, basically.
Yeah. Oh, no.
That was nice.
No, the whole caper episode, which, again, much more ground, not like, well, we're doing a cool caper thing. It felt much more
desperate.
Serious. Yeah. But, like, yeah, no, I was on the edge of my seat for most of that episode. So.
And then go out and the things are falling. Yeah, there's the, I think the third arc is very dystopian.
Mm. That's the thing that feels the most strange about it. And I was thinking about this in this show and a little bit with The Mandalorian, that Star Wars definitely feels much more comfortable on the outer rim in some ways. We know these inner rim planets exist, the more opulent ones, but it always feels a little weird when we're exploring them, like we've stepped into some other sci-fi franchise. It's not Star Wars, even though we know technically it still is part of the universe. But it feels a little different until we kind of do a mental readjustment.
Because Star Wars seems to always have a sense, you know, it's hard to pin down the elements of Star Wars. Some of it's, you got the droids and the look.
Mm-hmm.
But some of it also this sort of, this weird mix between high tech and low tech.
Yeah.
Like weird barren worlds, but speeders sort of thing.
Uh-huh.
And the movies especially pushed that, especially the originals.
Mm.
And even the prequels to a certain extent, though we did go a lot more to Naboo and Coruscant.
Yeah. Naboo was one of the planets we saw that was more opulent, but still.
But you have the Gungans to add that.
Yeah.
That balance
the alien vibe.
Yeah. So it's interesting. But it'll be interesting one to do. I think they both fit in the world. Obviously, I think some people will far prefer one to the other. I wouldn't want everything to Andor, but I really enjoyed it.
Yeah. I think Andor is interesting. I do kind of wish that some of the people who prefer the Andor style of things would not be kind of harsh. I don't know. There seems to be a backlash against sometimes the more lighthearted stuff.
Yeah, but see, I love the Mandalorian because it is the escapist, like, just, it's adventure. I want more just adventure stories, too. I mean,
yeah.
We talk about in our story school, diversity of stories is a good thing. You don't need all one type.
For sure. For sure. And I think I always, like, kind of rebel against the idea of, like, adult means dark and gritty and depressing.
Yeah,
like,
I would agree with that.
I like the escapist stuff, too.
Yeah.
Anyway. So I've been talking a lot of Star Wars. Was there a book you wanted to talk about?
I guess technically the book is a play. I was at the library, and they're always giving away, like, old books they're just going to get rid of. Or we're going to go to the library sale and find, and gravitate towards the classic books that look like 100 years old. I think this one actually was 100 years old. But it was a play, Peer, I'm probably say it wrong, Gynt, P-E-E-R, space G-Y-N-T.
Okay.
Right. Written by Ispin. It's a play. Most people, if they know anything about this play, the musical piece in the Hall of the Mountain King is incidental music for the play.
Oh, okay.
And Morning Mood? I think that's another incidental piece. If you heard it, you'd recognize.
Okay.
But it's about this guy, Peer. I forget what country this is from. I want to say it's Scandinavia, Denmark or something. I don't know. It's kind of hard. It was kind of hard to read. It's also a translation from like 100 years ago, like 1913 or something. So. Mm. From a foreign language. But to summarize it, it's about this guy who says he's going to be himself, like to thy own self be true sort of thing.
Okay.
And what it ends up being is that then he's just selfish. Like, he's not going to adjust himself for anyone else. Mm. So he goes through all these he runs away with this girl, and then he ends up in the Hall of the Mountain King, and he almost turns into a troll. And then there's one girl that loves him and waits for him, but he's like, oh, I can't marry her because I have this kid. I had this illegal kid with this other girl. And so he goes down to make tons of money in like Saudi Arabia or somewhere. And then they start a war, and then he becomes a prophet of this tribe, and they find out he's a false. And then he ends back home, and then basically a guy called the Button Molder. Well, basically, Satan wants his soul, and he's trying to...
Wow.
So, yeah, it's a weird combination of, like, realism and surrealism.
This sounds like a wide-ranging play.
Oh, yeah,
it must have very minimalist sets,
no,
I'm guessing.
No, no. It's very interesting. I guess to summarize, I'll just use this one scene that I think summarizes why I think it's so fascinating. Because the trolls have this thing is, to thy own self be enough. That's their phrase versus to thy own self be true. Because he realizes by the end of his life that he doesn't have anything because he's always just been so concerned with himself. And like this girl's been waiting for him for like 20 years.
Hmm.
It's just kind of talking about how people who are, that tendency to rework the world into your own image kind of is destructive.
Interesting.
Which I think is interesting now, I mean, in modern culture.
Yeah, it sounds like it, like a modern idea to combat.
I know, it's crazy. But it's like late 1800s or something like that.
If only they know how much people will try to warp the world to the way they like it.
But I guess the scene that kind of captures the idea, I think, best is, it's written in verse too, which is interesting, is he ends up in, running away, he ends up in this mental institute, this insane asylum. And he's made king of this insane asylum because everyone there only sees their version of the world. They're all insane and they only see their version of the world. They're like, hey, you can be our king because you also do the same thing we do. It's so basically saying, you know, it's like right there in the smack dab in the middle of the play, this idea that like the end of reworking the world only around yourself is insanity.
Hmm.
Again, I'm sure people who know it better and study can say, hey, that's not exactly the meaning or whatever, but that's what I got out of it.
Interesting.
It's a fascinating play. I would like to read a little more modern translation just because it's a little rough sometimes, but maybe that's just because written in verse,
okay,
how it's going to be. I think it was completely worth it. It was fascinating. Yeah, it's all over the place. I'd love to see it perform sometime because
sure,
it'd be something else.
Well, that sounds like something for your youth group to aspire to.
Yeah, I guess so. There's the intro. He's not a great guy. Like, he's very much a scoundrel, but he's kind of one of these... He's constantly quoting other things, like he knows stuff, but he doesn't really, and he's always kind of this sort of like, you know, kind of Han Solo, but like more scoundrelly, and but always very bravado about everything. He's a very interesting character.
Okay.
And at the end, this guy's like, you got to prove to me that you're... Like, he's not even bad enough to go to hell or go to heaven just because, like, he doesn't do anything bad, but he just it's really weird. Very, very super. It was very surreal at the end of it. The devil's trying to get his soul, and this guy called the Button Molder, like, hey, you got to prove that you did something bad. And,
yeah, wild.
It's wild. It's a wild play.
Huh.
So that was kind of my, my big book that's not in the book club that I've read so far.
Cool. Well, I've talked about it a little bit, but I got to talk a little bit more about The Muppets Mayhem.
Yes, please do. But I haven't had a chance to watch it yet.
Oh, man, you totally should. I mean, I already talked a little bit about what's one of its greatest strengths, that it lets the Muppets be the Muppets. It's also highly unusual in that it is just about the Electric Mayhem.
Which is an interesting choice, but maybe smart.
Yeah, I think it's a really clever way of doing something fresh to really give the spotlight to some characters who haven't had the spotlight much, especially in the last 30 years. And I mean, I'd say Kermit doesn't, for the most part, he doesn't make an appearance. He doesn't make an appearance. There's a few allusions to him.
Okay, yeah.
But like, he's the only one, which I guess could be seen as a little bit of a complaint. It might be nice if more of them had appeared in like the finale or something.
Yeah.
But I do certainly appreciate the fact that it is so much just on the band. That's super fun. My other criticism probably, well, okay, one's a nitpick and the other one is more of a critique. My nitpick, it is a sitcom that falls into some sitcom cliches.
Yeah.
You'll probably be like rolling your eyes or like kind of doing something else while some of the human plot lines play out. Cause like, okay, this episode's about learning not to lie. Eh? Okay. Well,
yeah,
whatever. There's some of that. My critique, I guess, I'm not sure which is actually the critique, which is the nitpick, but anyway, maybe this is more the nitpick, but the fact that the show doesn't look like it was fully color graded. It feels like a lot of it, they just did their raw footage out of the camera. Not that the cinematography is bad, But it's off. The colors are awfully drab for a show featuring the Electric Mayhem.
Mm.
Like, I think some of it's meant to help it look like this is a real thing happening, as opposed to being super bright and color. Like the Muppet movies of recent years, you know, Muppets 2011 and Muppets Most Wanted, were very colorful and saturated and stuff. And this is not so much. And I'm like, did you guys actually do any color correction here or not? I know maybe that is very nitpicky, and only me would care about that. But like, and it's not hugely distracting, but if you compare the, like, all the advertisements for the show and the intro itself, how bright and colorful that is to the actual show, it's a marked difference. But the performers do a great job with the characters. Everyone feels like the actual characters. And they do something, some fun stuff with Lips. He's the trumpet player.
Yeah.
Who's been around for a long time, but has never really had as much personality as he does here.
Mm. Oh, nice.
So a lot of fun stuff.
I want to give props whoever decided to sell this show, because like I would never have thought of it. And it's a great idea.
Yeah. It's fun. Like I said, imperfect. There's some moments that are like, okay, just get past this part. But I can recommend it much more wholeheartedly than I could the 2015 series.
Nice, nice.
So, all right. Any other stuff?
Well, I guess just a quick one.
Give me your quickies real quick.
Okay, so Mouse, the comic, the graphic novel, I guess you'd say.
Okay.
There's two parts. I meant to read part two and I have not yet. But if you don't know, it won an award a while ago.
Yeah.
Several awards.
I'm familiar with this book, although I've never read it myself.
But anyway, it's about, okay, so everyone's a mouse in it. Well, let me say that again. All the Jews are mice in it. It's the story of the author interviewing his dad about his experience during the Holocaust. So there's scenes where the author is in the book interviewing his dad. His biography. I mean, it's true. It's not made up.
Sure.
Interviewing dad. And his dad's crotchety. The author at one point in the comic says, I make this comic, but my dad comes off like all the racist Jewish stereotypes. Like, so he comes off as very penny-pinching and curmudgeoning and like, don't throw anything. Anyways.
Is that why he cast them all as mice?
They're cast as mice because they're the ones being, the Germans are all cats.
Oh, okay.
And then different other nationalities are different animals. But they're just mice because they're being treated like mice. Like, they're just herded. They're the prey.
Sure.
And then they do a lot of flashbacks to how his dad grew up in Germany and met his wife and how the ghetto started going. It's very compelling. I mean, it's just black and white pencil drawings.
Mm-hmm.
You think the mouse thing works great. It's not like overdone. It just adds something to it.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, it is very compelling stuff. You can read it very easily. Well, I mean, it's dense. Now,
yeah, I'm sure it's hard, but...
And again, the first book got to the ghettos and I think the deportation.
Okay.
Part two is actually Auschwitz.
Okay.
So I haven't read that part yet. But there's still enough just, you know, the Holocaust and World War II.
Mm-hmm.
But just an interesting combination of biography and history and the author himself processing this stuff. And I started book two, and there's a scene where the author is drawing himself trying to write a book saying, how do I communicate Auschwitz? Mm-hmm. So it's sort of meta in places, but like in a thematic way.
Interesting.
So it is, I mean, I've seen it around and, you know, it just kind of goes in certain circles.
Yeah.
But it was completely worth it. Yeah. I need to finish it, but it's pretty interesting.
Okay.
Do you have any quickies?
I guess, again, bouncing from a much more serious thing to a lighter thing again. Going back to the Muppets, I just finished a book called Salmon Friends, a story of Jim Henson's first television show, which is, again, all about, like it says in the book, his first television show, which he did in the mid-50s to early 60s. It's one of these periods that's talked about or touched on very briefly in a lot of Jim Henson biography books or documentaries and stuff. But it's never been given the main focus because a lot of it is not available anymore. You know, it's before a lot of TV shows could be recorded easily. So, but what the author did, he went through the archives. They did have a lot of sound bites and scripts. Certain episodes were recorded. The audio was recorded, but not actually the video. So there's two main parts of this. The first part is the nonfiction stuff, and it's all about it feels kind of biographical about the show. Well, about Jim and Jane, his wife, working together. And then the second half of the book is an episode guide.
Oh, interesting.
That lists out as many episodes of Sam and Friends as they could find information about.
Interesting.
And some of it is just, you know, back then they were doing a lot of lip sync to novelty records. I mean, you learn a lot about musical acts from the 50s and early 60s that Jim used the stuff. And, you know, nowadays, it probably would be like copyright since you're probably going to get away with the way you did back then. But and then the longer Sam and Friends went on, the more Jim got comfortable with doing voices. And so you get to read actual sketches. And it's quite fun. I mean, some of it, reading through the episode guide, some of it will get tedious. And it took, like, I got this for Christmas. I just now finished it. But at some point, I started, like, reading some of it while I was playing Splatoon 2, waiting for online matches to start up. And it's just fun stuff. So, I mean, this is a book that's definitely for hardcore Jim Henson, Muppet people. Yeah. But I would appreciate it getting a chance to really look behind the scenes of this very early stage. And it'd be nice if there was more stuff from that period that survived. But we'll take what we can get.
Yeah. All right. So I guess that's our take on Tales.
Fun stuff.
All right. So, Tim, do you see that weird-looking guy over there?
Yeah. He just seems to just be wearing his long underwear with some jeans pulled up over overalls.
I don't know.
And a top hat.
I don't know. He's giving a weird stare.
He is. I think we should not have anything to do with it. Probably try to get out of here.
Maybe if we just go straight, we've got to find a way out of here, right?
I should think so. I can't see where. I mean, it didn't even look like there was much desert actually. If you go that direction,
yeah,
I feel like I actually see some water straight.
Okay,
so maybe we're on an island.
Okay. Maybe.
I don't know. It'd be weird. This western town on an island.
Yeah, but hey, weird things have happened.
Yeah, true. I'm sure we'll have no trouble leaving.
Nope, not at all. So anyways, folks, hope you enjoyed that episode. You can always check out our website at derailedtrainsofthought.com. I almost said Blogspot. and you can follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, all your various podcatchers.
And don't forget to check out the Weekly Hijack, I think we've mentioned, is still going on currently with The Prisoner.
Which has been a blast, guys, and you should join us.
Yes. If you've never seen it, it's a classic 1960s British sci-fi dystopian espionage show.
That sounds about right.
Yeah. It's been fascinating. Yeah, if you've never seen it, check it out, and you can watch it along with us and listen to an episode of Hijack after you finish an episode of The Prisoner. Meanwhile, it's time for my soundtrack. And when I was thinking about what is currently going on in gaming culture today, well, currently it's The Legend of Zelda.
It's Tears of the Kingdom.
Tears of the Kingdom just came out. And
like, everyone's been waiting for that. And they probably lost lots of workers for a couple days.
That's true. The amount of time people just sunk into that right away. I mean, I have not yet to play Breath of the Wild, so I'm not going to be playing this. Honestly, I have actually never beaten a Legend of Zelda game, as strange as that sounds. Although I am working to fix that. I am actually playing A Link to the Past right now. So I decided to pick a soundtrack from a remix from that. This is by the one and only McVaff,
da-dum,
a longtime OC Remix remixer. This remix is called Hyrule Castle Pulse Mix. As you might guess, it is a remix of Hyrule Castle, which one of the fun things about playing A Link to the Past is I was just going through it and it's like, oh, I know this song.
Because they've been remixed forever. Yeah,
exactly. I was very tempted to use the Disco Dan has a version of this song.
It's like 7 minutes, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, it's great. It's absolutely wonderful.
It's a great one. But this is a fun EDM version of the song. So I hope you enjoy.
All right. Well, this has been Nick.
And this is Tim.
Adios.
Bye-bye.